local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York City is to stop most land purchases in the Catskills watershed. Under a new agreement, the city will also adjust conservation easements to allow utilities like internet to pass through its land. We'll talk to Meg McGuire of Delaware Currents about why some folks are celebrating the decision. Gratitude. The folks at Sullivan 180 are here with a message appropriate for today. Maggie Fitzpatrick is here, too. She's the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, talking about how you can focus on your food to help you feel your best. And Tanner Simon from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance is back with some grant information for artists out there. All that coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Social media researchers are warning the public to be extra careful about online content they see that's related to today's election. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, that's in part because social media platforms have rolled back their online protections since the presidential election in 2020.
Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter all cracked down on election misinformation after the chaos surrounding the 2020 election. But the platforms have since loosened their rules. Facebook and Instagram say they police political ads less now. YouTube is no longer taking down videos falsely claiming the 2024 election has been rigged. And Twitter, now X, has become a playground for conspiracy theories and false claims about the election. Researchers fear false claims of voter fraud and exaggerated claims of voter irregularities could spur real-world unrest or violence. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Former President Donald Trump was campaigning until the early hours of this morning. He closed out his run, as he has in the past two campaigns, with a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan. As NPR's Dan McKeith reports, Vice President Kamala Harris and her campaign are working today to get out the vote.
Vice President Harris is calling into radio programs in every swing state today, still trying to reach potential voters before polls close. Campaign Chair Jen O'Malley Dillon says Election Day turnout will be key to what they expect to be an incredibly close race.
We really feel strong about the fundamentals, but we know we still have to work all the way to every poll closing to make sure every vote gets in there, and that's why we've built such an extraordinary organization to do just that.
That includes mobilizing thousands of volunteers to make calls, send text messages, and knock on doors to encourage likely supporters to vote, betting big on Election Day turnout. The Trump campaign encouraged early voting this year. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Donald Trump is planning to cast his own ballot today in Palm Beach, Florida. NPR has learned that he'll then participate in virtual town halls across the country. Tonight, Trump will host a watch party at the Palm Beach Convention Center. Stocks opened higher this morning as Boeing employees voted to go back to work. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 250 points in early trading.
Boeing machinist approved a new contract ending a walkout that's disrupted jet production for more than 7 weeks. The deal calls for pay raises totaling 38% over the next 4 years. Machinists could be back on the job as soon as tomorrow. In good times, Boeing is one of the nation's biggest exporters. The Commerce Department said this morning that U.S. exports fell in September. Imports were up during the month, and the nation's trade deficit widened to more than $84 billion. Facebook's parent company has been fined $15 million by South Korea for collecting personal information about its users to share with advertisers. A privacy watchdog says the information included sensitive data on users' politics, religion, and sexual orientation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Voters are deciding today who controls the next U.S. Congress. About a third of Senate seats are being decided today, along with all the seats in the House of Representatives. House races in California and New York could determine which party has control of that chamber. Arizona voters will decide today whether to give local law enforcement the authority to arrest people for crossing illegally into the U.S. from Mexico. NPR's Ben Giles has more.
The GOP-backed ballot measure mimics Texas's SB4 by creating a new state law criminalizing crossing the U.S.-Mexico border outside of a legal port of entry, an offense that's already illegal under federal law. Proposition 314 would also create new penalties for individuals who use fraudulent documents to obtain employment or public benefits and increase penalties related to the selling of fentanyl. Polls have shown the measure is popular with voters, despite warnings from critics who've likened Prop 314 to SB 1070, Arizona's infamous Show Me Your Papers immigration law that was largely struck down by the Supreme Court. Ben Giles, NPR News, Phoenix.
Officials at a hospital in northern Gaza say the Israeli military has struck their building, wounding at least six children. The World Health Organization says it had just delivered medical stores to the hospital. The WHO says the Israeli attack continued during that delivery. The National Hurricane Center says Tropical Storm Rafael is passing Jamaica. Forecasters say it will soon become a hurricane. The storm could pour heavy rain on the southeast U.S. this week. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today, of course, is Election Day, and a reminder to go out and vote. If you need more information about where to vote, you can go to our website, wjffradio.org. You can also check out all of the interviews and information we've been bringing you up until this point. But today, we're not going to talk about the election. We're going to talk about a few other things of equal importance, if not more, in some aspects of our area. Residents and local officials in the Catskills are celebrating an agreement that puts an end to a part of a decades-long land acquisition program by the New York City Department of Environmental Protection to protect the watershed of the city's reservoirs here. Meg McGuire is the founder and publisher of Delaware Currents, the news project dedicated to telling the story of the Delaware River from its headwaters in the Catskill Mountains of New York right here to the Delaware Bay, where it meets the ocean. She's joining us now with more. Meg, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being our antidote to the election news today.
That's what many of us are doing. Once we have the job of casting our vote, then we're trying to figure out how to spend the day without just biting our nails up to the elbows.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about something that's some good news for folks. Some folks,
yes.
New York City stopping most land purchases in the Catskills watershed. Let's talk about what this decades-long land acquisition program has been by the New York City Department of Environmental Protection and why it's changing.
Well, I think the New York City, the folks that work on the water for New York City are absolutely laser focused on getting the right possible water for its customers, right? So there's always been a feeling, I think, that anything else is just not going to take the DEP's time or attention, right? And I think there's been a certain amount of resentment about that. But I think in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, we've seen that the city folks are sort of taking their responsibilities to the whole of the watershed that is in New York State more seriously. And I mean, we've seen that first in the fact that we now have this flexible flow management plan that helps the river not get dewatered, or maybe not, you know, not too much water and not too little. Of course, that's a bit of a thing right now with the drought we're experiencing and with the aquifer project. But and this has been sort of a culmination of that. They actually went ahead and did a study on what lands do they actually need. And what they figured out with the help of the science, of course, it's always helpful to use science to figure it out. They figured out that essentially if you keep a close eye on the lands adjacent to the reservoirs and perhaps to the feeder streams, those are the most crucial ones. So that then instead of sort of having a unified focus over everything that might be, you know, considered near the water, the reservoirs, they are now sort of focusing the attention on lands that are immediately close to and would then have a direct impact on the water supply. And I think that some of the folks that live near the reservoirs, the feeling has been that this pressure from New York City to buy land has in fact taken the land out of perhaps economic development, so that some of the towns and villages up there haven't been able to grow naturally and develop economically. with this new decision, I think the folks in the north there, the Coalition of Watershed Towns, who have been talking with New York City about this, have finally reached a more equitable solution to the problem, which is that I think everyone recognizes that New York City needs clean drinking water. We all do, right? And the truth of the matter is, as the New York City looks after the reservoirs, that helps the river, as it comes down to the rest of us, you know, feed us clean water as well. So, but I think what's happening here is that there's been a change in the balance, and it's something that Rick Coombe was clearly delighted that they had reached this agreement.
And Rick Coombe is the chairman of the Coalition Watershed Towns that advocate for those watershed communities. And let's remind folks again, too, that this program from New York City rolled out in 1997 across Delaware, Greene, Sullivan, Schoharie, and Ulster counties to protect its drinking water supply. And we know it's a lot, but just as a reminder, that water supply serves 9 million people and provides 1.1 billion gallons of water a day to the city and Hudson Valley communities. So people were always sort of worried about stunting economic growth in the area because of this program and the loss in property tax revenues. And as you mentioned, things have changed. So does this seem as if it's going to help folks gain some more economic impact?
I think that is the hope. Economic impact is such a greasy little thing. It's like you look for it in some places and you try and build up to sort of support it, and then it's sort of, you know, something happened and it disappears. So it's no sure thing, but it is certainly, I think, a step in the right direction. And I think it once again is sort of evidence that the New York City folks are trying to pay attention to their neighbors and to be a better neighbor than perhaps they have been perceived to be in the past.
And the city is saying that there, quote, will be no more priority 3 and 4 acquisitions, which is most of Greene County land area. Can you talk a little bit about these priority areas and how those priorities are shifting?
Well, I would encourage anyone who has an interest in this to either check my website, or if you run the story on JFF, that would be great, just so people can see what the actual areas are, because you really do need a map to sort of understand what is the priority and what isn't the priority, because it's a bit of a patchwork, because, of course, it follows water, and water doesn't follow geographic boundaries. Water goes where, you know, it wants to. So it looks like a bit of a patchwork, but it does seem to indicate that where it's close to the wet reservoirs, those are more like priority one areas. The more distant it is from the reservoir, the less interested New York City is. So that sort of defines the A to, well, actually, it's, we have 1A, we have 1B, we have 2, 3. I mean, we have all sorts of numbers and letters in the map. The map tells the story best of all, I think. And you could certainly reach out to the NYC DEP. You could probably reach out to the Coalition of Watershed Towns to get some specific details if there's a piece of property that you're particularly interested in. I think that they would be able to get you a more specific geolocation of where these areas are now.
Yeah, it is a colorful map, and it does look like a patchwork, really. And we will put that up on WJFFradio.org. It's also DelawareCurrents.org. But it does give you a better idea of, like, how where these priorities are and just how extensive this system is. When you say, you know, the Catskill Delaware watershed, you're like, oh, okay, great. It's huge. It's a huge area.
It's really huge.
Yeah.
Right. When I started Delaware Currents a while ago, I was a little more ignorant of watersheds than I am now. And it is amazing the distance that a watershed can encompass. And in fact, as you know, I think your readers know, this watershed is then a sub-watershed of the whole Delaware River watershed,
right,
which extends into the 4 states. It is most massive in Pennsylvania, but the presence of New York City in the New York City piece of the water, New York City watershed piece of the watershed, is tremendously important, both for the people that live there and for the rest of the people that use Delaware River water downriver.
And Rick Coombe, who we mentioned, is the chairman of the Coalition of Watershed Towns, which was formed in 1991 to basically bargain with the DEP, is quoted in your article at DelawareCurrents.org as saying, quote, "This agreement stops them," New York City, "from filling their bucket, but we need to have them also let some out of it, which will take a much longer time," end quote. So talks are continuing. So there's a framework of an agreement, but they're still talking.
Yes, yes. Like many of the things to do with water management, it's always a balance. You have to supply, you know, the chief charge is to supply the drinking water. But there is, of course, always the chance, and certainly the Upper Delaware has felt this the most, that when there is a storm and the watershed, the reservoirs are overfilled, there is a danger of flooding. And there, you know, that's almost routine, which is horrible for the towns affected and the homes affected. So there's always this balance between how much water do we need, how much water can we sort of release. I mean, you know also that the releases from the reservoirs are dictated by a Supreme Court decision. You know, when states argue with each other, the case goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that it was okay for New York City to build the reservoirs, but they had to keep the flow. They named a place called Montague, but the actual gauge is in Milford, Pennsylvania, for reasons I don't know. But anyway, the gauge is in Pennsylvania, so it has to keep at a certain tempo or a certain rate. Because, of course, one of the jobs for the New York City Water, which is sort of insane if you think about it, is they have to be pushing enough water down to push the salt front away from the Philadelphia water intakes. And that's not just Philadelphia's water intakes. It's New Jersey American Water, and there's industry down there that take water from the Delaware. And all of those intakes, though, would be harmed by having salt. And that's where, you know, Philadelphia is, you know, quite a distance away from the ocean. But in the tidal push of the ocean, that tidal push can push waters far up. So pushing the water down becomes the job of the largest water supply in the watershed, which is the reservoirs. And, of course, there will be conversations about that because as we enter an era of climate change, we actually have entered the era of climate change. Just look outside at the weather we're having in November. Mm-hmm. Ooh. You have to start thinking about the things we used to take for granted in times gone by. It's not going to be that way. And what constantly the scientists are telling us about our area is there are going to be less water when there's less water, droughts. Look outside the window. And then more water when there is water. So we're going to have these weird little, like big, rather, storms that will suddenly park themselves somewhere. And some no-name creek can become murderous and flood an area that has not been flooded before. So how, this is getting a little further afield from the subject we started talking about, but I think it's worth thinking about that anyone who is concerned with our water supply and with the threat of flooding has to be constantly vigilant about what the weather is bringing us and then plan for the long term about what we're going to do when we can't depend on the water systems that we have depended on for so many years. When there is a drought, when there is less water, what to do to help people prevent a flood affecting their home or their town. It's not as simple, and it was never really simple, but it's not as simple as it was before. Mm-hmm. So this is evidence, to my mind, of that understanding of how we have to modify the places we were before and start to come to a new understanding of how we work with each other to keep us all safe and to keep our drinking water clear and clean.
While we have you, and then on the subject of a few other areas here, any update about the Delaware Aqueduct, the shutdown of that to get repaired? It's the longest tunnel in the world, and New York City's principal water supply aqueduct. It's been called the world's largest plumbing repair, shut down on October 1st. Any updates there that you're hearing?
Well, the Delaware River Basin Commission is having one of its meetings tomorrow, which, of course, I will dutifully attend. Luckily, it's by Zoom. There is likely to be some conversation about this because we're in a weird situation because New York City is still by virtue of the Supreme Court agreement, required to have that amount of water coming down the river and making sure that it reaches the right amount when it hits the Montague gauge, right? Now, counties all over the watershed and parts of states all over the watershed are experiencing drought. When that happens, the river usually is in a drought stage because there is less water in the river, too. But because of this decree, the reservoirs keep on having to pour out the water. But, of course, what the DEP folks have had to calculate, and, Lord, I wouldn't like this job, how much water will there be in the reservoirs when the aqueduct work is finished because the other reservoirs they're depending on are likely to be exhausted? So what they were hoping to do is have full non-Delaware River reservoirs and to empty the Delaware River reservoirs according to the pre-agreed plan, but still be able to kick in enough in May or June. Obviously, the end date depends on whatever obstacles they encounter, to be able to then sort of switch everything around and then once again, make sure their prime objective, of course, is getting those 9 million people who depend on its water, making sure they have water. So it is an interesting place to be, and I imagine I will be writing a story off that, and we'll certainly put it on my website as soon as I can, either later in the day tomorrow or Thursday, because I think there needs to be some wiggle room somewhere. There's a couple of things that are happening. I mean, I think most of us, when we were going into this, were more concerned about the possibility of flooding because it was just the tail end of hurricane season, and we know what rains the hurricanes can bring, right?
Yeah.
And so we were more concerned about the possibility of flooding. But with this extended drought, there's a whole new set of circumstances that people have to be somehow prepared to maneuver and manipulate around. So I will certainly see what is being talked about at the DRBC tomorrow, and I'll write about it tomorrow afternoon or evening.
Well, and I imagine that we will certainly have you back to talk about it as well. Meg,
I imagine, yes.
Meg McGuire, the founder and publisher of Delaware Currents, the news project dedicated to telling the story of the Delaware River. You can find all of their reporting and great work at DelawareCurrents.org. Meg, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
And stay strong. You've got a long day ahead of you, Tim.
Don't we all? Thank you so much. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
We'll take a break and more Radio Chatskill next.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes. Exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9. Here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. I think still Tim Bruno. You are listening to Radio Chatskill. And next up, we're talking to Sullivan 180. The Sullivan 180 team is bringing their experience and knowledge to help build a healthy Sullivan County, one degree at a time. And joining us right now are Denise Frangipani and Anne-Louise Scandariato. Did I say it right?
Nice job.
I get nervous every time, Anne-Louise. Hi, guys. Good morning.
Hi. Morning.
And we're glad that you're here because you're going to talk to us about, you know, your great work, too. But when I asked what you guys wanted to talk about, you said in one word, which I thought was so appropriate for today, gratitude.
Yes.
Which is lovely. And we all need to hear these things. So tell us a little bit about the gratitude message you want to impart.
Sure. So this is the season of gratitude. And in our world, it kind of kicked off back in September when we had our evening of appreciation, which was really an opportunity to get everyone together to acknowledge the hard work of all of our volunteers and our partners who are collectively trying to propel Sullivan County forward toward a healthier, healthier community overall. And it was our way of saying thank you and congratulations, because this is the kind of thing where it's the journey, not the destination. We know our goal is 180 degrees of health improvement in our communities, but everything that happens along the way, those 1 degrees at a time, are what's moving us forward and what we have to celebrate as we move forward together. So we wanted to say thank you. And our volunteers being the center of our work, we want to acknowledge their efforts.
Did you have a few that you want to single out? Yeah, Louise?
Sure. I feel like we have such an incredible wealth of support throughout the community, but I have the pleasure of working with a lot of our volunteers, whether it's through our grant programs or initiatives. I would like to highlight one in particular because I love some of her comments. Kat Johansson, who works with White Sulphur Springs Sullivan First Group, who helped beautify White Sulphur Spring, their main street, throughout the year. But she kind of shared that community is a special word, perhaps the most important one here. This grant builds community by giving us the reason to work together, engage people who are otherwise not in a group or in contact with each other, and to do so with a purpose.
And that was from someone who received one of the beautification grants in White Sulphur.
Correct. And the team of White Sulphur Spring are all volunteers, mm-hmm. who it's important to them about their sense of place, what they do, welcoming people as they either come and visit or drive through. And that is just one of so many individuals who help our community.
I was going to mention the driving through, because White Sulphur Springs is just down the road from our studios here on Route 52, and it's on my way home and to work. But I will drive through and see people out planting and making it more beautiful. It always makes me feel good. So I have gratitude myself.
There you go. And, you know, I know we talked about this last month when we were here, Tim, about Farm to School Month, and we had done a food service conference in August. So we just want to extend gratitude also to all of the food service staff throughout Sullivan County who feed our children 2 meals a day while they're in school. These are the unsung heroes, you know, kind of behind the scenes. Although my son, who's 12 now, will always tell me how the ladies in the lunchroom are so nice. And they are, but they're also really working hard, and it's not easy work. And I don't know how often they get to hear someone say thank you, but we want to thank them, especially now as we're trying to change the culture of our cafeterias and how we prepare and serve the food for our children. We're asking a lot of them to make a shift toward a different approach. And based on their feedback and their enthusiasm, I'd say they're on board.
Who else do you want to call out as a thank you?
Sure. So I feel like our gratitude, though, goes that no one can do this alone. This is really about our community in overall. I also have the pleasure of working with our interns. So we have a lot of our volunteers in the community give of their time for the grants, but they also then mentor young individuals between the ages of 16 and 20 who work seasonally in the communities. And so many of them are excited of the interns when they start the year because of being paid to do something. But it really, at the end, it's because they get to build relationships. They feel part of something bigger. Allie was our intern this past year in Barryville in the town of Highland. And she said, in the end, the internship opened my eyes to a new perspective. It showed me that there is good in the world, no matter how small the world may seem, and that I have the power to make it even better.
Wow, that's great.
And that's because of community members supporting a grant and supporting an intern. So there's such a ripple effect.
And how about how many interns do you usually have that go through the program?
Depending on the need of the grants, we have had anywhere from about 8 to 14 or 15. In addition, we also have a program assistant who works directly in the office with
us. Great. And this is the time of year where you're sort of planning for next year, I guess, and some of the programs are ongoing because of the school programs you mentioned. Are there some next steps in terms of some of the school programs, the Healthier Generation programs that you want to highlight?
So another gratitude out to all the teachers and the advisors who are keeping those programs alive in our schools. So the EHD program is in its full swing cycle for the school year. We have five schools that are in the competition of that. And so
remind folks the competition.
So the competition is five schools who've received some additional funding to take their work to a higher level within their school building. And they are competing for additional grants that they will bring back to their schools. So in addition to just doing the grants and kind of in the basic level of the program, they've raised the bar a little bit more. And we encourage others to think about that because it brings more resources. And it because of the way the competition is structured, by default, it creates additional collaboration and the need to work together and access to resources that will come into the school for additional projects and initiatives. I just want to mention one thing as we're going through this, and that when we think about what we're talking about here today, it's very grassroots and it's very much at the heart of our mission. But if you step outside of even Sullivan 180 and you think about where we are in history, and I heard someone mention a similar comment this morning on, I think it was Morning Edition, this fact that, you know, if we think globally, we can be overwhelming. And, you know, especially right now, there's a lot of stress going on many levels, and things might seem out of our control and out of our hands, thinking that broadly. So back to that old saying, think globally, act locally. We can, through our work and the work of many partners on a local level, we can really make a difference. And we're seeing that.
And you're seeing that. I was just going to say, you're seeing that every day. And, you know, if you look at, I'm sure, like numbers and statistics and reports and things like that, but you're seeing it in just what you're hearing in these comments from people who participate in the grants that they receive. So. Sure. I know that you have a list of things there. There are more people you want to talk to.
There's so many. You know, an impressive piece of it is really the joy of end result, or really of a connectedness that so many people don't expect to happen through so many programs and supports through people who engage with each other. Whether it's through our grant program or us working with partners, there's people show up who are looking to be engaged. They show their persistence and perseverance, their dedication. They help share their knowledge of new ideas and thoughts. That so many people were grateful for the impetus, their belief in something other that they bring to us that we are fortunate to help create. So that's all part of our gratitude to the people who apply for a grant or bring a grant to fruition, to our Sullivan 180 volunteers, to the firefighters who participate in the Healthiest Fire Department Challenge, to people who participate on the school's wellness committees, our community health champion trainers, to our interns, our advisors, our coordinators.
And municipal staff, the Parks and Rec folks who are out there creating programs for their community, using public space, activating that public space. I think the jury is still out on how to measure this impact right now. The best way we can measure it is by engagement. And when you look at the level of engagement and the variety of groups that are involved, because they have a resource and they have support to follow through on their vision or their dream. So many of these projects might not happen without the funding, but they definitely wouldn't happen without the volunteers who take the lead and say, I'm going to make this happen in my community.
And if folks that are listening want to be part of this gratitude-ness that's happening there with you guys. I just made up a word. How could they get involved? How could they volunteer?
Sure. Well, they can always call us, 845-295-2680. They can follow us on Facebook. They can go to our website, sullivan180.org. There's a lot of prompts in our website to, you know, click on, get involved, reach out. They could become volunteers. They could be connected with a project that's already happening in their community, so they don't have to start from scratch. Maybe they have an expertise that they feel would contribute to community health, and they could bring that. And most importantly, we're open to suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you guys want to say before we go?
We're grateful for our partners, but we're very grateful also for Radio Catskill. Well, for you, Tim Bruno.
I was just going to say.
And the whole team, Jason. And
Patricio behind you there.
Behind us. You guys are doing incredible things here.
Thank you.
And thank you for keeping us all informed and connected and giving us an opportunity to share our work.
Well, and I want to say I'm grateful to you guys because normally your monthly appearance is on a Wednesday. And when we looked at the calendar, we said, you know, we're probably going to be talking about something else on Wednesday.
Perhaps.
A lot of election coverage. So can you move to the day before? And you guys said, no problem. That's great. And then you brought this message of gratitude, which we all need to hear. So thank you so much for that.
And you know what? Everyone, just thank someone today.
Yeah. There you go. Denise Frangipani is the Chief Executive Officer of Sullivan 180. And Anne-Louise Scandariato is the Director of Community Engagement. You can find more information about their work at sullivan180.org.
Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Take care.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we have information for artists and grants for you from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. Today is Election Day. In New York, polls are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. In Pennsylvania, polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. All completed mail ballots must be received by Pennsylvania County Election Offices by the time polls close. A postmark by that time is not sufficient. Listen to Radio Catskill for local and national election news tonight and in the following days. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now, this next voice you're going to hear, you may have heard last week, but very, very briefly, because we were rushed for time. Tanner Simon is the Gallery and Grants Manager at Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, and we really rushed him through last week. So we said, come on back and give you a little bit more time. Tanner Simon is joining us this morning to tell us about some arts grants for artists in the region. Hello.
Hi, Tim. That's right. Yeah, thank you for having me back on the show.
Thanks for coming in, and we apologize for the rushed nature of last week.
Oh, I'll talk real slow today. Don't worry.
So we talked the last time you were here about the informational session that you had on Saturday. We wanted to get that information out. Was that well attended by folks?
Actually, it was the best one on record, I believe, so far. We had 26 people attend.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was very good. A lot of individual artists, a lot of arts organizations from the county. So a good mix of all of the different types of grants that we offer.
Yeah. So you want to make sure that folks know, more widely, what are these different types of grants? Because the grant cycle for this batch ends at the end of November, November 30th.
Yep, that's right. So what ends at November 30th, 2024, are grants for community arts education for 2025. So essentially, the community arts grants are for any kind of public event, such as one of our grantees, the Calicoon Center Band, offers concerts during the summertime. They have a series of 8 concerts that they offer through, I believe it's June and July, or July and September, August, whatever one is
the
after.
Summer, yeah,
yeah, in the summer. So those are free and open to the public, and they use that funding to pay the band and to promote it and to otherwise host the event.
So these projects can include theater, music, dance, literary arts, folklore, installation, visual arts, among other art forms.
Yeah.
And they can be for independent artists or groups.
That's correct. Yeah. So if you're an individual artist, you can apply with a fiscal sponsor, another nonprofit organization that will essentially, they'll get paid the money and then they'll pay it out with you. So you'll be working with a nonprofit, even if you're just an individual. But it's still, public project that you're putting on, public performances and shows.
And what's the range of grants for this community arts grant?
The range is in the budget.
The money available.
So the lowest amount we offer is $500, and the highest is $5,000. And the average is right about in the middle at 2400.
And there's typical. At DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, there's more information about the specific grants and how to apply. But just within this grant, you do ask for a budget and what that will be used for. Yeah. You know, you ask folks to kind of outline all this, right? What's the process like?
Yeah, so we want the organization's budget for the entire organization. We want the project budget. And, you know, we want to see that the project is getting funding at least 40% from other sources other than the grant money that they're asking for. You know, it could be community donations, in-kind donations, which are, you know, non-monetary contributions, such as like a space. You know, the cost of renting a space can be quite expensive. So that's a really good thing for organizations to get. And and then photographs from a prior event. It's really good if you've done it before. That, you know, our panel really likes to see that there's a history. But if not, you know, it's good to come in with a really well-written proposal. And it's okay if it's the first project.
Yeah, and you're looking for a variety of projects. Yeah. Some of the past grantees have included Delaware Valley Opera, the Delaware Youth Center, Frederick Cook Society, Western Sullivan Public Library, Jeffersonville Enhances More Sullivan, and it's Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. There's a range of things, but you're looking for things that, I mean, the criteria is things that like enhance the community arts experience.
Yeah, for everybody. And, you know, it's okay if you're not an arts organization, if you want community arts money. You basically just have to be a nonprofit that's doing an art project. So, you know, it could be a business nonprofit organization for, you know, something about beautifying the town, but it's okay, you know, as long as the project is art related.
And that application deadline is November 30th.
November 30th.
The other application deadline that's November 30th is the Arts Education Grant.
Yes.
Now, how is that different from the Community Arts Grant?
Well, the Arts Education is for, there's two types. The one is working directly with public schools to teach a closed group of learners in that setting. And there would be a curriculum, et cetera. And the other group is community-oriented, where it's working with maybe residents of a senior care facility or a chorus group that's, you know, outside of a school. So it's not necessarily open to the public in that regard, but anyone could join those other groups.
So it's more education-focused here. Is that the main difference,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Because they seem pretty similar.
It's learning how to do art skills, you know, not like art history necessarily, okay, but physically making the art.
And the range of grants are similar from
$500 to $5,000.
And you also have that similar process. You're looking for the budget and you're looking for the, you know, background.
Yeah, and of course, an educational background and teaching is great for this grant. And it's okay if not, but you still need to make a curriculum. And it's good to partner up. If you're doing with the school, you need to partner up with them and get a letter of commitment that, you know, this public school wants to work with you, or this chorus group wants to work with you ahead of time.
And another opportunity for funding, individual artist fellowships. That application deadline is a little later, January 30th, 2025. Who's eligible for those fellowships?
Well, we have three different types of fellowships, and it pretty much, I believe, if not, let me know, but I believe it covers every type of medium out there. We have visual artists, which could be sculpture, painting, performance art. We have compositional arts, which could be composing music. It could be choreography. It could be theater, and we have literary art, which could be, you know, any type of writing. It could be poetry. It pretty much covers everything. And there is a community engagement aspect, which could be, you know, having an artist talk, an exhibition. It could be some kind of screening. It could be working with the public to make the art. And the money is unrestricted. It's $3,000, and it could be used for paying your rent while you're making art, or if you need to pay your rent and go on a residency, or for art materials, and you don't have to report a budget for that. You just need to have a strong, dedicated portfolio and, a can-do attitude.
Well, and it really is kind of amazing because, you know, it goes to the idea that, you know, encouraging artists to pursue their profession is key to keeping, you know, art alive in the community, arts and culture alive.
Yeah, well, you know, our mission is really to fund arts organizations and artists in Sullivan County, because we don't necessarily have the same opportunity that artists do in New York City. You know, we're a pretty rural county. There aren't any cities. There's a lot of hamlets, which I didn't know that was a real thing until I started working here.
A hamlet, yeah. There's a village, there's a town, there's a, it goes on and on.
Yeah, I thought that was just a fairy tale thing. That's real, and, you know, foolish me. But, yeah, it's a really good opportunity to kind of keep the arts alive and to keep, you know, cultural activities alive in the county. And that's always been the DVAA's mission. And I do want to note, before anything happens here, that we are funded by NISCA. So it's not our own money that we have to spend. We get a grant from NISCA, which is funded by taxpayer dollars and the Office of the Governor, state legislature. And then we just re-grant it. So we have our own panel that kind of – I don't make any decisions, but we work with a panel that kind of votes on – what projects get funded.
And tries to distribute that out as much as possible to folks yeah. who have applied. As you said, it's a statewide community re-grant program of the New York State Council on the Arts, which is also known as NISCA. And so when folks apply by November 30th in one of these places, either arts education or community arts grants, and by the way, you could apply in both, right? There's not a restriction on one or the other.
Yeah, so you can apply for up to three projects between arts education and community arts, and you won't get more than $5,000 between all of them combined. So, you know, there's a cap on the amount of money that you can receive for it. But, you know, if you only need $500 for each project, you know, you have a chance of getting all of it.
And so once folks apply, what are the next steps? When does this panel meet, and when will folks be acknowledged or notified that they've received the grant?
The panel is going to probably start meeting January, and they'll make decisions in February. You'll be notified in end of February, early March. The public will be notified probably later on. And then by May, there will be an award ceremony where you will get a very large check. I hope it's very
people
large.
Like the big large
yes,
check.
I can't promise that, but that is typically the deadline. And of course, after you do get funded, if you don't get the amount you asked for, you kind of have to revise your budget to make sure the project can still work. And then if anything changes, you'll have to keep in touch with us so we can make sure that it's the new project that you're changing it to is still within the spirit of the original application, because you can't turn around and be like, well, I'm going to open a bakery with this money instead, which is a great thing to do, but not with NISCA.
Doesn't really fall within the guidelines.
Not art money.
Now, you've only started this job in July, so you encourage people to reach out to you and you'll help them out. But I would just like to advise, go easy on Tanner. He just started. So how can folks get a hold of you to learn more?
Well, you can email me at grants@DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, which you will find on our website. If you just click on it, any of the emails will reach me eventually. You can call us and I'm there to answer the call. And definitely check out our website, DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, and you will find all the information there under Empower, go to Grants, and then it's, you know, Community Arts, Arts Education. You'll find it all there, and it'll take you to Submittable. But please reach out to me. I'd love to talk about your project. We can even meet in person and have coffee.
Look at that. That's such a lovely little touch
coffee.
There. Tanner Simon is the Grants Gallery and Grants Manager for the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. Before we go, I promised at the top of the show we weren't going to talk politics or the election today, but I noticed when you came in earlier, you had a pin that said, vote for Tanner. Are you running for something?
So in high school, I ran for class president. I was already the secretary, and I thought, you know, now is my last chance to make it big, and I did not get it. I did, however, successfully get the VP elected. I had a really big coup planned. I did not get elected, but I had beautiful pins. One of my friends made pretzels covered in sprinkles.
Well, lovely.
And my logo, my slogan was Simon Says.
Clever.
And, yeah.
Clever. No wonder you landed at an arts organization. Tanner Simon, Gallery and Grants Manager for the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. Thank you for being here.
I think you
landed at a better place.
Thanks.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, Maggie Fitzpatrick is here from the Sullivan County Democrat. She's a health and wellness columnist. Boy, we could hear from her today and use that advice. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Jason Dole reminding you to stick with Radio Catskill tonight for special election night coverage. Join me, Patricio Rubio, and Philip Pantuzzo of the Times Union, Carter Walker of OPPA, and Leah Mayo and Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter tonight at 6 for a live one-hour local edition election night special. NPR special coverage starts at 7, and we'll keep checking in with our live guests, including Ian Pickus of WAMC News and Laura Flanders of Laura Flanders and Friends. It's election night on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Tuesday, and we are checking in with Maggie Fitzpatrick from the Sullivan County Democrat, as we do every Tuesday. She is the health and wellness columnist, and her column is Moving Toward Health. Now, today's topic, focus on food to feel your best. I have to say, like, I've been focusing on food the last, like, 24 to 48 hours, but not feeling my best. So how can we do that? I've been eating away my anxiety. How can you feel your best when you're focusing on food? What do you mean by this?
Yeah. So last week when I came in, remember I told you that I was going to write about food and then it just didn't happen. So today we're following up last week's article and we're actually talking about food. Okay. So you just brought up a really great point that it's really easy to focus on food and not feel our best, right? So we want to think about a couple of things that we can do that will help us feel our best. But the foundation of this article is really following up on last week when we're starting to rebuild our healthy habits, right? So when we have, when we're in this place of feeling like we need to start over, we want to rebuild our habits. Today, I wanted to talk about how we can do that in the realm of nutrition.
And you're talking about it in the sense of like when you are, you know, out in the world, basically eating as well, and how you can kind of focus on what foods will make you feel better.
Yeah. So I really tried to focus on three things that you can do to help you start to recreate these healthy habits around food when we're starting to rebuild, you know, what we're doing in terms of our routines. And the first one for me is water.
Water.
The reason why this is always the first thing that I focus on is because it is the thing that has the most immediate impact in the way that I feel. I notice when I'm not drinking enough water, I don't feel good. I get headaches, right? Any of those like dehydration symptoms. And as soon as I start drinking more water, I immediately start to feel better and have more energy. So that's always the first place that I start.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I try to focus on water as well. And then there are times where you slip back into like, why do I feel like this? Oh, I haven't had water for a little while. Like if I drink, you know, it automatically, as you sort of train yourself to this idea that you need to stay hydrated, which is something we always talk about, but in practice, when you kind of forget or you haven't had it for a minute, that's like sort of an instant like refresh, really.
It really is. And it's a very habitual practice. Like yes. Once you get into the routine of drinking more water, I love to, you know, bring my favorite water bottle with me and I'm one of those people. But once you get into that practice of continuously drinking it, it's easy to continue doing that, right? It's one of those that once you create momentum, it's easy to continue on with it.
Well, the next nutrition habit you say you focus on when you're rebuilding health habits is increasing vegetable and protein intake. I think we all want to try to do that. So what are some of the ways you go about that, or what are some of the realistic ways you go about that, I should say?
Yeah. So the next thing that I focus on, like you just said, is veggies and protein. And another reason for that is just simply increasing those foods in my diet helps me feel better, right? So that's why I like to focus on those things. And I like to do it as stress-free as possible. So that means I'm not trying to create a ton of pressure on myself to meal prep and have every single meal planned out and, you know, make sure that it's all perfect. What I'm really trying to do is when I'm thinking about, okay, you know, the next meal after this is lunch, right? How can I acquire a lunch for myself that maybe includes a vegetable and maybe includes a source of protein? And I really just try to go into each meal with that mindset of how can I curate this meal to include vegetables and protein? And then before you know it, you're eating way more vegetables and protein without this overwhelming stress of trying to count your macros or, you know, figure out how many calories you're eating or all of that. We're just simply starting with how can I eat more of these things that are really good for me.
I had this sort of low level anxiety attack about I didn't eat anything green yesterday, but then I realized I for lunch and for dinner were both meals that I had made myself leftover, but like they were nutritious. They were like good meals. Like, so I was like, don't worry about the green part. You're going to be fine. I mean, there were vegetables in those.
There's also lots of colorful vegetables.
Right. And they were vegetables. Anyway, open yourself to other colors, Tim.
Yeah.
And then the other thing you talk about is decrease your consumption of refined carbohydrates and not only do that, but like prioritize doing that. So how do you do that? How do you prioritize it?
Yeah. So you want to go into this with the same mindset as the vegetables and the protein. We're just thinking about maybe how can I avoid some of these things instead of include them, right? So when we're talking about refined carbohydrates, we're talking about foods that are broken down extremely quickly in the body, which cause huge spikes and decreases in blood sugar, which really doesn't make you feel good. Right? It makes you feel like maybe you have a lot of energy for a second and then you're really tired and then you're really hungry again, right? We're not feeling satiated throughout the day. And these things can include your thinking like, you know, your white bread, your pasta, your cookies, your anything like that, right? Lots of processed foods, lots of sugar. And so when I'm thinking about my next meal, similarly to how can I include vegetables and how can I include protein, I'm thinking, okay, what in this meal is maybe a refined carbohydrate and how can I maybe replace that with either a complex carbohydrate, which is like a whole food, maybe a whole grain, right? Or a version of a food that is slightly less processed. That way my body has to do a little more work to break it down. Or can I just replace that entirely with a whole food, right? So maybe a fruit, a vegetable, a protein source, right? Or just eliminate that food altogether. And if I'm thinking about that, if I'm just consciously aware of it for every single meal, then we're going to start to naturally decrease the volume of those foods that we're eating, which again, helps me feel better.
There you go. Feeling better by prioritizing some strategies and your healthy habits. And as you said, this is like when you're thinking about a rebuilding phase, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to like focus on these habits that will make you feel better, drinking more water, increasing your protein and vegetables, and trying to decrease, but prioritize decreasing these refined or processed carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
Good messages to hear on any day.
Yeah.
Especially today.
Yes, especially today. These are great things to do when you're feeling that, you know, overwhelm of stress or anything like that. And they're just great foundational places to always come back to regardless of what's going on.
But it's okay to have a glass of wine or a slice of pizza.
Of course.
You understand I'm asking for permission.
I actually had pizza for dinner last night because sometimes you just get home and you're like it's the day of the frozen pizza.
This is the day of the frozen pizza. It could be the week of the frozen pizza. Okay. Anyway, thank you, Maggie Fitzpatrick.
Thank you.
She's the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. The column is Moving Toward Health, and you can find it on newsstands or at scdemocratonline.com. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that we will be bringing you election coverage throughout the day through our news partners. And then at 6, it's a special 1-hour local edition with local perspective. And then tonight at 7, NPR news special coverage of the election with local cut-ins from our team here as well, bringing you the latest as polls close. And if we learn anything, we will let you know. A reminder to please vote. Polls in Pennsylvania close at 8, and in New York, they close at 9. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, is America switching from booze to weed?
I think if everyone who was using alcohol was instead using cannabis, it would be a much safer, healthier world.
But has the legalization of cannabis outpaced the research?
No one has studied the majority of products that are out there today.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Wednesday night, our series America, Are We Ready? Will invite your calls on the results so far of the 2024 election, including the presidential race, the battle for control of Congress, and the many consequential ballot questions around the country. I'm Brian Lehrer. Join me and Fordham University political scientist Dr. Christina Greer as we grapple with the state of the vote and the state of the nation a day after the polls close. America, Are We Ready?
Tomorrow night at 8 on Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election.
This is Radio Catskill Local News, Culture, and NPR. Today's weather, breezy this afternoon, a high of 68. Increasingly windy tonight to a low of 54. Tomorrow, the warm weather remains as do the breezes. Breezy with clouds and sun, high 69. Cloudy, mild tomorrow night, low of 50. And for Thursday, sunny, a little bit cooler, high only 56, low down to 35 Thursday night.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Made possible by listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org. Listen on air, live streaming at wjffradio.org, or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.